If you could have a conversation with anyone in history, what would you ask them?
Hello, General Washington. Good day, Miss Tubman.
I had to know, so I decided, let's give him a call.
Welcome to the Calling History Podcast.
Welcome back to part two of Mercy Otis Warren. In the last episode, we talked about Governor Hutchinson and his role in the adulator as Rapacio. We talked about her brother being attacked and almost killed. In this next episode, we're going to find out what happened to her brother Jemmy after the attack, as well as Mercy's plans to release another publication addressing what happened at the Boston Tea Party. She's always shaking things up. You gotta love her.
It is because of my brother and his brilliant mind and his way with words. It is because of him that I am able to take my first step into the political realm. And because of his passion, he frequently would run afoul of individuals who did not share his opinion, who did not believe that he should be voicing his opinion the way that he does. And one instance, there was an individual, a scoundrel named Mr. Robinson, who set upon my brother and beat him mercilessly with the cane. I thought we were going to lose him. He has not been the same since.
Where did this happen?
In Boston, sir. Messrs. Eves and Gill covered the horrific attack in their newspaper. They made sure that Mr. Robinson would not go without being known as the attacker of my brother.
Is there no punishment for somebody that just beats somebody with a cane?
Enemies of my brother will say that dear Jemmy brought the attack upon himself. He has retired from public life. He has begun to recant his previous sentiments about Crown and Parliament. Friends and family have distanced themselves from him, but I cannot bring myself to do the same, sir. You understand. I cannot abandon my brother.
He's your brother, regardless of what he believes, but your brother is absolutely recanting his original statements and his passion for liberty?
Again, sir, you must know that this is not my brother. This is a man who is injured, and part of why I believe it is my job and my responsibility to take up the pen in his name and to carry out the work because the job is not finished.
Are you at odds then?
No, sir. No, sir. He does not know what he is saying, and the love of a sister for her brother takes precedent over anything else that I can imagine.
I'm so glad that you do continue writing because your words are so powerful and you definitely are speaking for the two of you. And I'd like to go back for a minute. I want to go back to the adulator for a minute where you wrote that story with Rapacio. And I think the other character in that, wasn't his name Brutus?
Yeah, that was my brother, sir.
That was your brother, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
And so Hutchinson is the bad guy. He's Rapacio and your brother is the good guy. And he's Brutus. I guess what I'm wondering is, what was your goal in writing that? I mean, it was such a huge success and people are interested in it, but what are you actually trying to accomplish? What would you hope that would do?
It is my hope that through my writing, and specifically through this play, to perform a civic duty, if you will, where individuals in town who are having these discussions of a political nature need to have a creative outlet to be able to discuss openly. And while we do have relative freedom of the press in the colonies, the history of satire and the history of comedy as a way to process events and individual actions of a local or, in this case, of a personal nature are one of the ways that individuals in polite society can continue these conversations.
That makes a lot of sense. I did not expect that answer at all. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to create the framework that allows the people to have these difficult conversations in a way where maybe they don't know how to do that. They don't know how to comfortably talk to one another about what they feel because they may disagree. Where if they're talking about this play, they may be able to say, that kind of reminds me of when Governor Hutchinson did that thing and it was terrible. And that's kind of what this play is like. And it just kind of opens the conversation. Am I on the right path?
Yes, it is far easier to have an impassioned speech come from the mouth of a character. Rapacio becomes a household name. It becomes a name that individuals begin to refer to in writing, in public discourse. And of course, when anyone uses the name Rapacio, they know really, truly of whom they are speaking.
It's kind of Rapacio wink. So did everybody know that Brutus was your brother?
When you are with a group of friends and you are sitting and you are reading a work such as this, there is much discussion as to who might be which character. And what has happened in our news, as you can see in our newspapers, is that individuals are choosing to criticize the government, but not using their own names. That is a very dangerous thing to do. So yes, I believe most individuals, when reading my work, know that Brutus is James Otis Jr. So are there individuals that might be having a thought at who the author of these plays are? I suppose so. But again, it is not the duty of my sex to take on such aggressive forms of political action.
And yet, it appears that you created the code that allowed people to talk about government openly without them knowing it's happening.
I would argue one avenue, sir. One medium. What?
Okay. Okay. I'm with you on that. So when we're talking about the adulator, how does this story end? You had mentioned Rapacio, who is Hutchinson, basking in the glory of his schemes, I think you said, and him thinking that he is just fantastic in every way. But how does it end? What happens? What's the story about?
Well, the past year, the Boston Gazette additionally printed another play of mine, which is The Deceit, in which Rapacio makes his appearance again. And of course, Limpinch is there. Limpinch is Oliver. And the second installation of this play reduces Rapacio and Limpinch to the schemes of what I would call their prostituted pen.
So then The Defeat was the second part of this, where first you tell the story and then you show that he loses. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. What direction do you think things are going in your time? Do you think that there is going to be some bloodshed? Do you think that you're going to figure things out with England? What happens next?
Well, sir, I hope that when you refer to bloodshed, we of course have already had a horrific incident in the year 1770 in Boston, in which 5 noble colonists lost their lives at the hands of British soldiers. I believe all of us, regardless of Whig or Tory, recognized that the shedding of blood at the hands of government troops, there would be no reconciliation from that. That is what you are referencing. Being the year currently, I can't imagine that our government will not respond, as I mentioned, to the destruction of the tea. How they decide to react is still to be determined. My hope is that if it is after boycotts and it is after bloodshed and it is after a very strong political protest in which property is destroyed, that our government has no choice but to yield to the common sense that it must be for our government to understand that their actions are a violation of God-given rights that we have as men and women.
So when you say our government has to yield, it appears to me that you have two governments. You have the government of the colonies or Massachusetts, and then you have Parliament, and they both want different things. So who are you saying is going to yield? Do you think Parliament needs to understand they need to yield?
As it stands, our government in Massachusetts is a tool of Parliament. I cannot imagine how Parliament or our current government in Massachusetts continues or plans on continuing to govern effectively when so many of the people are making their feelings known through writing, through conversation, through action. And this is men and women.
So are you anticipating that we're reaching a boiling point and there will be more bloodshed?
No, sir. I hope with all of my heart that is not to befall us.
Five is enough.
Five is enough.
I want to go back to something that you had said when you were talking a little bit about the Sons of Liberty. At Liberty Square, your home, which I love that your home is Liberty Square. The Sons of Liberty attended some of those meetings at your home, correct?
Individuals who have a love for liberty, sir.
It seems like those meetings played a huge role on everything that was going to happen next. It almost seemed like it was the government behind the resistance.
We do not confuse ourselves to be a government, sir. We are law-abiding and loyal subjects. What we see as a parlor in which like-minded individuals can gather and discuss the various ways that action may be taken to remind those in power that the steps that they are taking are, again, not appreciated and are illegal.
Okay. Let me ask you about some people. Sam Adams, his name came up. What was your relationship with Samuel Adams?
My husband has had correspondence with Mr. Adams, but I personally do not have a relationship with Mr. Adams.
What is your impression of him?
I believe that Mr. Adams, who is very much respected, again, by Jenny and, of course, my husband, I believe that there are many different ways to approach how our government is mistreating the people of the colonies. However, it's not necessarily an approach that I would take or I would encourage my husband to take.
I may be wrong on this, but Samuel Adams is not married in your time, I think. And one thing that you had said is that sometimes a woman's responsibility or something along these lines, their job is to soften the man's approach to whatever he's trying to say or do. And it doesn't appear that he had that female touch to soften what he was ever saying.
Mr. Adams did have a wife, but I am not quite sure that there would have been any influence that would have softened his approach.
Yeah, maybe so. How about John Hancock?
Mr. Hancock. Yes, everyone knows Mr. Hancock. Mr. Hancock is in frequent correspondence. I also speak frequently through writing, correspond with his wife. And the Hancocks are quite lovely. Mr. Hancock is a lover of finery and somewhat of, I would politely say, a scoundrel in the way that he was one of the first recipients of these writs of assistance that my brother had written about and had argued against. Now, Mr. Hancock, while he should never have been subjected to a writ of assistance and subsequently his entire ship was confiscated, we have called it in Boston the Liberty Affair, named after his ship. There are talks around town that he did have some suspicious cargo on board one of his ships, but I believe that he should never have been subjected to such an unlawful act.
What was it like growing up in your household? Because you've written some very strong opinions of what government should do and what it should look like. And you have some opinions that you're being very humble about people that are not handling their responsibilities to the citizens properly. And you're doing it as tastefully as you possibly can, but it appears that your opinions are very strong. The opinions like this just don't come from the air. They come from somewhere. Did this start with your father? Was he a strong believer in liberty or the colonies perhaps standing on their own or maybe separating from England? What did your childhood look like in that aspect?
Oh, I had a wonderful childhood. I was born in Barnstable, which is located in Cape Cod here in Massachusetts Bay. I am the first daughter and third eldest. There were 13 of us, so quite a large family. And my mother and father were dutiful parents. My mother was a mother in whom was concentrated every excellent quality that could endear her to her family and secure her many friends, whereas my father, as I mentioned, quite a jovial man, was well-respected and loved by everyone in the community. Despite not having a formal education himself, he would write to people and encourage them to come to our home in Barnstable to visit him, where he could take up their case as a man of the law. And there were frequent conversations in my family about government. It was just a natural way of life, being that my father was in the law. My mother was not always present the way that my father was. And much of that had to fall on me as the eldest daughter to help my mother in taking care of my younger brothers and sisters, which I believe I did so in a beautiful way. I hope that you don't think it vain of me to say that I was a dutiful daughter. Do you have any siblings, Mr. Dean?
I do. I have in my time what would be considered a large family of six. It's nothing compared to the size of your family.
Are you, Mr. Dean, are you one of the elder siblings or a younger sibling?
I'll say Jemmy and I have a lot in common.
Oh, I see. So being the eldest comes with its privileges, but also it's a chore. And being a daughter, this is more so. And my mother, who was ever in the family way, relied upon me to help take care of the house and my younger siblings and to get them dressed and to help out on our farm. And you can imagine it was quite altogether very taxing. And it really was those times in the tutelage with Reverend Russell and my brother that allowed me a chance to escape the monotony of the household.
Were you kind of like your mother's right hand?
I had to be. And it was, again, it is the part of a woman's job and duty to run the household. And I think I do so in a way that would make my mother proud today. And I cannot say much of my mother except that she was commanding in all areas and in love. And she had made sure that we had strong Calvinist upbringing, to praise God in all that we do. She was deserving of all the love and respect that a mother deserves, a good mother.
It sounds like you have a really nice mix between your mother, who understands her responsibilities of running the household, and then your father, who takes on a lot of responsibility, it sounds like, including making sure that you received some sort of education, even if it wasn't formal education, like Jemmy and Joseph. I guess there's one thing that you said a little bit earlier that's kind of sticking in my head, and I want to know how you feel about this. You were asking me if our discussion, it was safe to have this discussion, and I was explaining that. And you said, it's nice to be able to speak about this freely. Mm. And I guess I'm wondering if you could explain a little bit further. What is it like to have all this knowledge in your head from the books and your original thoughts and these ideas, and yet these responsibilities to help your mother run the house, and yet you have all these things that you, it appears that you want to say and you want to write about, and it's not necessarily proper for a woman to do that. What does it feel like?
Well, books and writing have been my escape, and I was able to write my first poem just as my second son was born. I wrote it on winter. So the ability to use my observations of the world around me and to be able to put my emotions and my thoughts onto paper has been a great solace and comfort to me. But my primary job is to be a mother and to be a wife. And James, my husband, is my pole star. He is my constant companion. And we are so very fortunate to have such a love match in our marriage. You know, we courted for 6 years and we have 5 beautiful sons. My husband is someone who has constantly encouraged me to share my opinion. So I am able to do so within the confines of our bedchamber. And been hosting our friends and our connections at our house, I have been able to do so more on a frequent basis. And again, individuals like Mr. Adams, who continues to champion my writing, and Mrs. Adams, who in her own way, and my dear friend, Ms. Hannah Winthrop, who also encourages me to continue my writing. So while it's a relief to be able to speak about this freely and to know that in your time, women are able to write and to publish and to speak their minds, it is altogether quite remarkable.
Yeah. Your first son, James, and thank you for putting me in my place about that being a name of honor and not a lack of creativity, because I deserved that. So thank you. Now, who's the king in England right now? What's his name?
That is King George III, sir.
Do you not have a son named George?
Young George is 8 currently. He is quite a precocious child. But it seems that in your time, Mr. Dean, that names seem to have a very different meaning in your time than they do in ours.
They do, and that's why I'm confused. In our time, we just make up names. I know somebody that's named Star, you know, and somebody named Tree. I mean, they literally just pick it. They could name it after something. They could make it up. It's not like in your time. And I understand where James comes from, but where does George come from? I would guess that with some of the difficulties that King George is adding to our...
The names of my children are all connections to family. For example, Winslow and Charles and Henry. The practice of using names is altogether quite honorary. And I would not say that any of my children's names are unusual or suspicious in any way.
But it has nothing to do with King George. It would be your family.
No, not sir.
Okay. All right. There we go. Okay. I want to imagine something impossible with you for a minute. I'm fascinated by the way your mind works. And our conversation has not gone anywhere near the direction I was expecting. Not at all. I would have guessed that you were a hard charger. And you're like almost leading the men. And they don't know what to do. Not quite. But your humble approach to getting things done, it's impressive. But I guess let's just pretend for a minute, all right? Let's just really open the doors, all of them, all the doors and all the windows. And let's imagine that you had this gift of being able to write and to be able to persuade and to be able to write these stories like The Adulator that make people think and promote useful discourse in the name of liberty and everything that your work does. But let's say that you were a man. So you didn't have the restraints or the responsibilities of being a woman, that you were a man. What would you be doing differently than what you're doing right now?
What a wonderful question, Jardine.
Be completely frank.
I suppose that, you see, men have the luxury of being able to express their opinions without giving much thought to the reception, whereas women are constantly reminded of our place in society and our respective duties and responsibilities. I suppose I might not write very different than I am currently choosing to express myself. However, every time I put pen to paper, there is a lot of thought that goes into how I choose to present my ideas. And I believe it might be quite liberating to speak and to write freely without those constraints.
So do you change the way you write because you're afraid that it may sound like a woman or you may be found out that it was you?
No, I would not say that. I would say it is more of a personal decision that when I choose to write, I intentionally decide on the words and the phrases because I believe that the power of the pen and the power of the press is so great that only the most selected of words and the intentional use of the English language and command of the English language should be employed.
spoken like a true writer. Every writer I have ever spoken with, they're amazed that the world makes the assumption that a great writer just writes something, it just comes out of their mouth and it's done, or out of their pen and it's done on the first draft. And nothing could be further than the truth. A true writer sits and contemplates on a word for a day or a week sometimes, on a single word. I mean, that's what you're saying, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so back to the example. You are now a man, okay? And as a man, all right, no, this is impossible. But as a man, you had control of the choices that were being made in government. Now, both the government in Massachusetts and the government in England, they both have financial responsibilities. This ultimately all ends up being about probably money, even though power plays a role. If everybody had all the money they needed, nobody would have to ask anybody for anything else, and everybody would get along just fine. What would you change immediately if you were the person responsible for the decisions? Where are the governments dropping the ball right now?
It is the opinion of my husband and myself and those in our larger circle that the moment that Parliament had decided to circumvent the policies of government by allowing the colonial legislatures to make their own decisions, to pass their own acts of revenue, was the moment that we had lost sight of the covenant between the people and legislature. I firmly believe if we return to a system where government power may be checked by the people and the colonial assemblies are once again able to regain the power where individuals are elected upon merit and are championed by the people and are firmly placing their reliance back on the laws of English government, then we can return to a place of relative harmony in the colonies. But if government continues to circumvent those laws and wield arbitrary power over the people, then I fear for the future of these colonies.
It's hard to imagine anything fair happening when the people don't have a voice. I think you mentioned that the next thing that you plan on publishing is about the destruction of the tea. Can you tell me what your hopes are with that?
It is more of, as I mentioned, granting a favor to Mr. Adams, who would like to see this momentous event captured. What I hope to achieve with this is I hope to make Mr. Adams proud. I hope that I can put his ideas onto paper and to make sure that this poem accurately honors the men who took the steps necessary to send this particular signal to government. And as with any of my writing, I hope that it falls into your hands of people who appreciate and hope to be inspired by them.
Is there anything else that you're writing or something that you're hoping to write about in the future?
As frequently as I'm able to write to my husband while he is away or to my friends, I do hope to engage in more correspondence with Catherine McCauley, Mrs. McCauley, who lives in England. She has quite interesting ideas on the role of government, and she is someone I'd very much love to continue my correspondence with. I hope, Mr. Dean, that there is a time where I do not need to write of government content. I hope that there is a chance where I can return simply to writing about the glories of God and the beauty of nature and of family and poetry that makes my family smile. I hope to be able to step away from political writing. While this is something that gives me great pleasure to be able to, again, carry on the work of my brother, it does not give me great pleasure for the requirement to do so.
I see. That makes sense. You're writing it because it needs to be written right now. But if these things weren't happening and everybody was getting along, you might be writing about the history of Boston or something to do with nature or flowers or, like you said, God, whatever interested you. Would you be a good politician?
I know, sir. It is not the role of women to be politicians.
Now, remember, in my time, everything's open. You can change anything you want.
I do choose my words carefully, and I attempt to speak with eloquence and vision from my quill. And I hope that individuals respect that ability. I am not one to favor conflict, Mr. Dean. I cannot imagine. I, like most women, truly despise conflict, and far too often it's the men in our lives who take up the banner of provocation and advance the first step. As I age, I've come to realize that in dire times when change is needed, that a rational and careful voice is needed, and that when taken with action is the only direction towards resolution. Do I believe I would be a good politician? I cannot say.
When you say that you do not like conflict and women do not like conflict in your time, nobody really likes conflict. Everybody would like for everything to be nice and everybody to have everything they need, all the love and the money and everything they need. That would be fantastic. And yet for somebody that does not enjoy conflict, somebody like maybe John Adams, I think he might actually like it. But for somebody that doesn't like conflict, you really are good at stirring things up quietly. And you say women do not like conflict. Do you think maybe they don't like it because they don't have the power to change it?
Behind closed doors, women have an incredible amount of influence on their husbands. Mm-hmm. And also know, Mr. Dean, that women live politics. Every day we live politics. We discuss politics within our own circles. Women are reading the news. We are very much aware of what is happening. However, you mentioned what we are able to influence in our own realm is not always the same on a public level. And I guess I will conclude that thought with, should my quill and my ideas be an instrument of, I should say, God's plan to strike down those enemies of liberty? My only wish is that I do so in a way that glorifies his name. It is a way that I believe that I have been given, as Mr. Adams says, this masculine talent. It is something that I hope that my husband never feels that I have overstepped. And of course, for my five sons to be able to look upon their mother and say that she was attentive, she was loving, and that their dear mama did everything that she could to keep their happiness in mind.
As it sounds like your mother did.
Yes, sir.
Do you think there's any truth to the saying that men create the problems, and behind the scenes, women teach them how to solve those problems?
Aside from the measures of men who speak for us in government, I'm not so deluded as to think that the mere voice of the gentle sex is needed at any given point. However, I do say that, yes, my sisters are strong. And when they band together, change is sure to follow. You might recall in 1768, there were many instances of women banding together and joining in spinning bees and refusing to import fineries from England. And it was women who essentially brought Parliament to its knees to ask for forgiveness. Women have quite an influence. We live politics. We are able to present our cases in a very strong way. It is just not the way that men do, and it is not the way through government.
What does liberty mean to you?
Liberty, to me, means freedom to live one's life according to God's will, to glorify his name, and to be able to do so in a way that is not infringed upon with arbitrary laws of government. Our government has refused to listen to the people. And that government has been duly elected under the rights as outlined by Magna Carta and English common law. We may be colonists, but are we not English men and women first? And do we not honor our king with love as an obedient child would? And what our mother country has been doing in return is she was soon strike the hearts of her obedient children in the bosom with a dagger. Do you believe that it was the right of her to strip that manufacturer from her colonies? And I do not believe so. And Mr. Warren does not believe so. And that is where liberty must reign, is in the minds and the hearts of the people.
I've never heard it described quite that way. The way that you are responding to the king is as you would see a father. And the way they are responding to you is as if you were breaking into their home.
I would say instead of the tender embrace of the parents, we are being scorned.
Thank you for that. Now, last question. I love your poetry. Your talent has no bounds. And I wonder if maybe you would write a poem at some point. That had anything to do with this conversation.
I will need some time to think.
Okay. And if it never gets done, it's okay. I don't have any other questions for you. I am so thankful for all of your time. I can't imagine a world without people like you and Abigail Adams. I just can't imagine it. Is there anything else that you would like to say to future women or just anything you'd like to add?
Oh, Mr. Dean, I appreciated your questions. I very much enjoyed our time together. I believe that one should always champion that in which they believe, and to do so with prudence and to do so with authenticity. And I believe that would be my imparting thought.
I think that is a great place to end. Thank you again for all this time today, and I wish you the absolute best.
Thank you, Mr. Dean.
Prior to this conversation, I expected Mercy to speak firmly and powerfully about her beliefs. In fact, during the conversation, there were times where I tried to push her into saying what she really meant instead of hiding behind the role of being a dutiful mother and wife. Yet no matter how hard I pushed, Mercy knew better than all of us. If she were to be loud and brash and publish her works under her name, it could have ruined her and her husband's reputation and very likely would have prevented any of her words from being read at all. In fact, had she gone about expressing her ideas openly as a woman, perhaps these committees of correspondence meetings at her home might have never happened, meetings that were crucial, to which she later said, perhaps no single step contributed so much to cement the union of the colonies and the final acquisition of independence as the establishment of the committees of correspondence. Mercy's not only a hero to women, but she's a hero to all people who are marginalized and feel like there is no way for their voices to be heard. People like Abigail Adams and Mercy Otis Warren are as responsible for the creation of our nation as the men whose voices they softened along the way. Thanks for listening, and if you enjoyed this episode, subscribe now. I'm Tony Dean, and until next time, I'm History.
Mrs. Warren, I am surprised to hear from you again. What can I help you with?
Mr. Dean, I have been thinking about our conversation, and I am happy to let you know that your quest has been granted. You asked me to consider writing to you, and I believe that I have created a poem that might please you.
Oh, now I feel terrible because I didn't think you were actually going to do that. You have bigger things to do than write about me. But at the same time, I would love to hear what you came up with. So please read what you have.
Interlocutor by trade, calling history by name. Hearkening to days of yore, his trumpet sounds forth a query. His subjects echo in truth. Our noble narrator forges ahead steering. A single perspective, not forsooth. But how the tones of antiquity will record, a pod cast with seeds are sown, for posterity's sake values ever more to learn and teach and provoke and grow.
Oh, I love it. I want to tell you again, thank you for all that you did in this discussion that we had. And this is a nice final gift. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dean.